This is 1988 Tops, where every card has a story to tell. Your hosts are David McKellis and Matt Kuzma. Let's play ball. Welcome back to 1988 Tops. David, what's our card for this week?
Our card this week is Keith Hernandez, card number 610, first base for the New York Mets.
All right, fantastic. Definitely looking forward to this one. But first, some follow-up on previous episodes. And we want to introduce our guest, friend of the show and proprietor of the Journalism Salute podcast, Mark Simon. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Matt, we had some follow-up from the Willie Hernandez episode. First off, I said on the podcast that I wasn't sure if there were any cards that showed Willie as Guillermo. Hernandez did have a 1989 and 1990 card in a lot of sets. So Upper Deck, Tops, Donruss all had Guillermo Hernandez cards. But interestingly, his Donruss cards had Guillermo even earlier. So on the front of the cards, they would have Willie, and on the back of the card, it would say Guillermo Hernandez. Also, his 1988 Tops big card referenced both his name preference and also included his mother's maiden name, Villanueva, in parentheses, which I have not seen on other cards, but a really cool of the Topps Corporation on those big cards to include his full given name. And thank you to a few listeners for pointing this out to us over on Facebook and on Twitter that there were Guillermo Hernandez cards. Mark, you also had some follow-up from that Willie Hernandez episode?
Willie Hernandez closing out the 1984 World Series for the Tigers is a distinct last out in an unusual regard. For those that don't know, I am a proprietor, I suppose you would say, of Last Out tidbits, Last Out of the World Series tidbits. And that is the only Last Out of a World Series that you can find online, and it goes back like 70 years, where the announcer, Vin Scully, decided that he was going to go silent for the final out of the World Series, that it was just going to be the crowd tells the story with the pictures and the crowd sound. And it's a distinct call of the last out of the 1984 World Series. Vin Scully did not say Willie. He did not say Guillermo. He just watched.
That was something that was striking to us. We had that in our show notes. I thought, well, maybe we'll drop an audio clip in here after the last out. And then when I watched it, it's nothing, just bedlam on the field, the fans going wild because they were in Detroit for that victory. I think Vin, as so often he did, made the right choice on that one.
Compelling broadcasting because of the lack of a call. So the master at work. We also had follow-up about Tom Brookins.
Thank you to former guest Jeff Snyder, Snydog on Twitter, who pointed out to me on the 12-14 Immaculate Grid, there was a square for Tigers and played a game at catcher. And when he pointed this out, I said, I bet we have the same answer. And I named Tom Brookins because of the podcast. And if you named Tom Brookins, I accept your nickel you can send me for that low score. But then when I posted my results, Jeff said, oh no, we didn't pick the same player for that square. He had picked Scotty Madison. Scotty Madison, a person who, Matt, I don't know. Do you remember that we did a Scotty Madison episode?
We recorded an episode about Scotty Madison, allegedly. I mean, I know there's evidence of it, but
years from now, people will remember Scotty Madison. We did not remember that. I did not remember that he played a game at catcher, but Snydog did. That probably got him an even better score than Tom Brookins did. But again, Immaculate Grid, always a great source of internet content.
If the show helps you win big cash prizes on the Immaculate Grid, we would love a commission from that. You can email us, you know, Venmo or Chase Pay or whatever, to 1988topspodcast@gmail.com. But now it's time to talk about Keith Hernandez. Why are we talking about Keith today?
We talked about the other side of Keith's trade to the New York Mets a long time ago with Mark Simon. I think the first time that Mark was on the podcast. And when we were talking to Mark about a return trip to the pod, I asked who he wanted to talk about. And Mark, you suggested Keith Hernandez. Why is that?
A number of reasons. He's my father's all-time favorite Met. He's one of the best defensive first basemen of all time. And, of course, he's the other end of the trade for Neil Allen, Met legend, at least in my world. He's ripe to be discussed because there's plenty of good material on Keith Hernandez out there.
Keith won 11 straight gold gloves, a five-time All-Star, two-time World Series champ, an MVP, a Seinfeld guest star, Sesame Street guest star, and we get to take a trip to the RBI Corner. He also has a Sabre bio by Michael Martell. Thank you, Michael, for your work. And this should be a good one.
Cannot wait. Let's get to the front of card 610. And I am sad to say, gentlemen, that this is maybe not the best pose of a player in the 1988 Topps set. You've got Keith Hernandez wearing a Groucho Marx mask on his face and bending down to field a grounder at first. But his nose is all scrunched up. The mustache is in full effect. But he just does not look comfortable. He does not look comfortable at all. And for an 11-time gold glover, you would think he would just look so relaxed and at ease in this very easy moment of fielding a ground ball to first in spring training during the photo shoot.
That does look like a mask. I really thought that this was a joke. I don't think that his nose looks like that. Like, that looks like a fake nose. And he's got what looks like glasses. Are those flip-down shades that he's wearing?
Yeah, that was typical for him.
And he does have real stirrups on in this picture.
They're stretched in full effect. I don't know that we've seen that stirrups from the front in an action shot in this way. Looks really good. There's a lot of torque going on at those socks.
He also looks more comfortable at first base than Sam Horn did in his picture.
Yes.
That, I think, displays the difference between those two players and their defensive qualities and characteristics. This also is the first appearance of a captain's letter, which I did not realize was a thing outside of hockey.
Keith and Gary Carter were captains of the Mets in that time, so it makes sense that it was there.
Let's go to the back of 610, and we have Keith Hernandez, first base, 6 feet, 195, left-handed batter and thrower. Drafted by the Cardinals in the 40th round of 1971. Born October 20th, 1953 in San Francisco, California, with a home in New York, New York.
Born in San Francisco, initially lived in Pacifica, but then the family moved to Millbrae when Keith was in high school. Millbrae is right next to SFO, the airport in San Francisco, 15 miles south of downtown San Francisco. There were around 9,000 people in Millbrae when Keith was born, now around 23,000. He was born on October 20th, shares that birthday with Juan Marichal and Mickey Mantle. His father, John, had been a baseball prospect for the Dodgers, and Keith's last name, unlike Willie Hernandez, his family didn't come from Mexico or Puerto Rico or somewhere in Latin America, but rather his ancestry is directly from Spain.
So a quick point of order, Mark. Would his father have pronounced it Hernandez?
It's always been Hernandez or okay. Hernandez. Yeah.
Always a possibility when we talk about Spanish Z's.
While his dad is listed as John, Keith always refers to his dad as Juan. Juan Sr., Keith's grandfather, came to the United States from Malaga in Spain in 1911. The family first went to the Philippines from Spain, where they chopped sugar, then continued that trade in Hawaii, and then got on a boat to San Francisco. That's where Juan Jr. was born. Even though the last name is Hernandez, came from Spain, Keith was given the nickname Mex because of that last name, and that nickname annoyed him, and his dad didn't like it either, and he would yell, "Spain, where is that on the map? Europe!" John Jr. was a minor league player in the Brooklyn Dodgers system, and as a young man, he was a really good hitter. Not quite big league quality, he made it as high as AA, played for Brooklyn, Boston, Cleveland, St. Louis, and the Yankees farm teams in the 40s. He missed a couple years due to military service, but when he came back, he had a fantastic season in 1946, but then was hit in the head by a pitch. He had blurry vision from this injury, and an optometrist prescribed him with these prism glasses, and they messed up his eyes further, and his eyes continued to deteriorate. So he ended up dropping down the minor league ladder, was out of baseball by 1949, and became a San Francisco firefighter. But because of those early baseball skills, he taught and trained his sons, Keith and Gary, to play baseball. He would hang a sock with a tennis ball in it in the rafters of their garage, and the boys would take hundreds of swings a day. If they needed the ball higher, they would throw the sock a couple more times over the rafters so that it would be a higher pitch for them to swing at, but they developed that way, hitting a tennis ball in a sock over the rafters. Gary himself was a great player, was an All-American at Berkeley, still holds the single-season record for triples at Cal, and was also drafted in the 17th round by the Cardinals, made it as high as AA, and then went to work as a State Farm insurance agent. There was an article that I found about John Jr., Juan, and his baseball career. In it, Gary entered the chat in the comments to thank the writer for writing about his dad, also to defend his brother when some other commenters were going after Keith for drug use and other things. It was really touching to see Gary make those comments. Even as a professional, Keith would call his dad for hitting advice, and the relationship would get somewhat contentious. One article said that Juan had so pushed and ridden him that at times they were barely on speaking terms. And Keith said that that help from Juan was a blessing and a curse. Juan was the best coach to help Keith out of slumps, but sometimes Keith wanted to be his own guy and was reluctant to call his dad for advice.
Keith played at Cappuccino High School.
Delicious.
This was an area that was formerly called Rancho del Cappuccino, not named for the coffee or the monkeys, but rather for the Capuchin Friars, an offshoot of the Franciscan order. Other Cappuccino High alumni include former managing general partner and CEO of the San Francisco Giants, Bill Newcomb, opera singer Luana Duvall, Thighmaster salesperson, and Chrissy from Three's Company, the recently departed Suzanne Summers. Keith was okay with this move from Pacifica in high school. He said, "A lot of my friends got caught up in the drug culture and ended up in jail or dead. My dad knew what was going on, and he moved us to Millbrae near the airport."
At Cappuccino, Keith was an all-league quarterback in football, all-county guard in basketball as a senior, and an all-county baseball selection in his junior year. But what about that senior year of high school? Wasn't named to an all-county position, wasn't drafted, really? It's a little bit confusing. He actually quit the team as a senior in high school. So he didn't end up playing a senior year. He played briefly for San Mateo College. According to Keith, he spent one semester as a B-minus student there. But then in the 1971 draft, he was selected, according to Baseball Reference, in the 42nd round, the 785th player selected. Baseball Reference said that he was picked out of Cappuccino High School, not out of San Mateo College. So the timing's a little bit odd. I couldn't find any stats or anything from that time at San Mateo. So I'm not entirely sure when he played for that school.
After the draft, Keith didn't sign right away. In one interview, he said he was offered $3,000, and his dad advised him, "That's a joke," and wanted to negotiate. The Cardinals really weren't sure what to do, so they sent their director of player development, Bob Kennedy, in. And he said, "I don't know about the money, but if you don't sign this kid, you'll regret it the rest of your life." So they bumped the signing bonus up. Keith signed for $30,000. This is a 42nd round pick. Now, the card said 40th round, but we'll go with 42nd round from Baseball Reference. And $30,000 for a pick that low seems ridiculous.
That $30,000 number was the same that Jim Rice, who was the number 15 pick in the draft, received. Frank Tanana was 13th in the draft, and he was signed for $50,000. So the Cardinals didn't want to lose out on this guy after seeing him play. They didn't have much to go on because he didn't play a senior season, and I think they didn't want him to go to college. They maybe thought that he would have a college career. They just wanted to get him and get him started.
Well, it was a good decision. Keith started at A-ball in St. Petersburg. He hit .256 out of the gate with 5 homers in 84 games and was promoted to Triple-A Tulsa at the end of the season for 11 games. In 1973, he started at Double-A Arkansas and was one of the league's best fielding first basemen, but his bat wasn't really there yet. He hit .260 with very little power, only a .686 OPS. And Keith admitted his numbers were a little bad that first year at AA, but he still got promoted to AAA late in the year. He asked Bob Kennedy why they promoted him, and Kennedy said, "Keith, if I knew I left you in Little Rock, you might have hit .230 and been done. It could have destroyed your confidence and you would have been done. So I took a chance because I knew you had the talent." He hit better at Tulsa, .333 with 5 homers in 31 games, but he proved Kennedy right the next year in AAA at Tulsa, where he spent most of the year. And we have a fun fact that Keith led the American Association with a .351 average at Tulsa in 1974.
He was still only 20 years old. He hit .351 with 14 home runs, 6 triples, especially for a first baseman, pretty good, 18 doubles. And it was clear that he was just about ready for the pros. He was called up late in the season. He was the 10th youngest player in the National League, walks in his first appearance, got a hit in his fourth, a single. And over the rest of the season, in 14 games, he hit .294 with a .415 on base percentage. That's about Keith Hernandez level. But the next season, he started with the Cardinals, and he was hitting only .203 in June and was sent back down to Tulsa.
I know the Cardinals say they have the best fans in baseball, but maybe they don't have the best hitting coaches in baseball, because the Cardinals' batting instructor was telling Keith to hit every pitch to the opposite field, and that's not how he had ever played and had been coached before, so he slumped. Back in Tulsa, the manager Ken Boyer helped him get back to hitting to all fields, going with the pitch, as his dad had always instructed. He hit .330 at Tulsa, was back in St. Louis to close out the season, finishing with a .250 average in 64 games.
And over the next couple seasons, Keith becomes a complete player. And he got good advice from Lou Brock. He also argued a little bit, or got some tough love from Bob Gibson. Lou Brock would give him a pat on the back when it was needed, or sometimes a stern word or some instruction on how to deal with life in the majors. He also met his first wife, and he had a bat boy pass her a note to ask her for a date. They were married 2 years later. Between 1976 and 78, he averaged .277, 11 homers, 67 RBIs. That's a .120 OPS plus. The Cardinals were pretty bad in that stretch, losing 90 games in 1976 and 93 games in 1978. Also in 1978, he won his first Gold Glove, the first of 11 straight. As we go through, we're going to say, and then he won another Gold Glove a few times, or just maybe assume that he won a Gold Glove. After a fast start in 1978, hitting .330 through mid-May, he ended up finishing with a .255 mark. During a late-season slump, he argued with his dad and told him, "Don't butt in anymore. I'd rather 9-to-5 it than hear this." Basically, he was overhearing his dad's criticisms and told him, "I'd rather quit baseball than deal with you constantly telling me what to do." I think the next season, he proved that maybe that was the right decision, but it didn't start out that way.
Yeah, 1979 started the way 1978 did, where he was hitting as low as .213 in early May, and the press in St. Louis wanted him benched. Ken Boyer, who had been promoted from that AAA coach to manager of the Cardinals, told Keith, "I don't care if you hit 100, you'll be at first every day." And that gave Keith the confidence he needed. He turned it around, and this is his breakout season. He hit .367 from May 3rd to the end of the season, and we get a lot of black ink on this card.
Keith led the majors with a .344 average, 48 doubles, and led the National League with 116 runs scored. That's a .151 OPS plus, 11 home runs, but also 11 triples, and drove in 105 runs as well. He made his first All-Star game, won another Gold Glove. The Cardinals were pretty good. They finished in third place, winning 86 games. And at the end of the season, Keith showed up on the MVP ballot.
He got first in a tie. He tied Willie Stargell for the MVP, the first and only time there's been a tie vote for Most Valuable Player. Stargell had 10 first place votes. Keith and Dave Winfield each had 4. And there were some other random first place votes awarded, including Ray Knight, Joe Niekro, Gary Carter, Kent Tucholvy, and Bill Madlock. Those two other Pirates getting votes probably prevented Willie Stargell from an outright MVP. Meanwhile, Keith Hernandez was named on every single ballot, and Willie Stargell was left off of 4 in the calculations. It led to the two of them being a tie.
This is one where maybe looking just at wins above replacement doesn't accurately convey the value that a person has to a team. While Keith Hernandez was a legitimate MVP candidate, valued at 7.6 wins above replacement, he had a great season, career highs in average, runs, RBIs, hits, doubles. Also, you have Dave Winfield with 8.3 wins above replacement, Mike Schmidt at 7.9. But then you have Willie Stargell, and that Pirates team, as they're running through the National League, he was not the most statistically valuable guy on that team, but he made that team tick. Keith Hernandez said to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, "Willie was the sentimental favorite. He was the inspirational man for the pennant winners, with a lot of intangibles going for him. He was deserving." But later, in a memoir, Keith said he didn't feel like Willie deserved the MVP. Stargell himself said, "A taste of honey is better than none," of the split MVP vote. it's really hard to argue against Willie Stargell getting a share of this MVP for that great Pirates team. Keith, I think, was also a deserving winner.
But that split vote also leads many people to just forget that Keith Hernandez had won an MVP and that 1979 was the Pirates year and of Willie Stargell being the MVP there. So I can see why Keith Hernandez might have been a tad bitter about it. This recognition, though, and adulation, even if it was shared, did help Keith become more secure. He had been shy as a younger player, didn't really feel comfortable in crowds and parties, and he said, "I overcame it because of ego." It's a healthy shot in the arm to be called the most valuable player, I guess. And he followed this up with a great 1980 season, making another All-Star game, hitting .321, leading the league with 111 runs and an on-base percentage of .408. But just at the time he had established himself as a star, his personal life fell apart.
He separated from his wife. He started using cocaine. He was introduced to the drug by a teammate in St. Louis. And at this point, I think the public generally knew less about addiction, and Keith didn't expect that the drug would take over his life. It led to a binge in 1980 in which he suffered from nosebleeds and shakes. He developed an insatiable desire for more and admitted to playing under the influence of cocaine. Midway through 1980, Whitey Herzog took over as the manager of the Cardinals. Between Keith's drug usage and what Whitey perceived as a lack of hustle, the two had a difficult relationship going forward.
After 1980, the Cardinals started shopping Keith around, offering him to the Mets in exchange for Neil Allen, second baseman Doug Flynn, and pitcher Tim Leary, but the Mets declined.
This is crazy. I didn't know about this until you guys put this one in our script. Tim Leary was supposed to be the next Tom Seaver, so that's kind of why the Mets would have pushed off on this deal and not done it. They wouldn't have had a problem with trading Allen. They wouldn't have had a problem with trading Doug Flynn. The issue for the Mets was that the next year, in I think it was the third game of the season, Tim Leary started in a really cold, awful day at Wrigley Field. I believe it was his elbow. He got hurt in that game, and the Mets didn't see him again until 1983. In hindsight, I think they would have liked to have done this for Keith right there and then, but didn't happen.
The strike-shortened 1981 season was good for Keith on the field, and he hit .306 as the Cardinals missed out on the playoffs. Despite finishing with the best record in the National League East for the full season, if you remember, it was the leader in the first half and the leader in the second half who ended up going to the playoffs. In 1982, despite Keith's continued drug use and Whitey Herzog's frustration, Keith played 160 games that season and was a key part of the Cardinals' run to the World Series, largely hitting in the three spot ahead of silent George Hendrick. Keith hit .299, drove in 94, and stole 19 bases. Is that a typo?
That is not.
No, that is legit. 19 bases. Over the last 2 months of the season, he hit .337, helped the Cardinals win 92 games, holding off the Phillies and taking the National League East. And in the playoffs, Keith went 4-for-12 with two walks in a three-game sweep of Atlanta, sending them to the Suds series as the Cardinals faced the Brewers.
Keith was pretty good in this series. He hit .259, but had a .799 OPS. That included two doubles in a Game 5 loss. He hit a home run in Game 6 and drove in 8 runs in the series. In the decisive Game 7, down 3-1 with one out in the 6th, Keith singled to drive in 2 runs to tie the game, a huge moment in the series for the Cardinals. The Cardinals won 6-3 to take the game and to win the World Series.
So Keith was a world champ, perennial gold glover at first base, a career .299 hitter, a few years removed from an MVP award, and the Cardinals tried to trade him again. First, they were close to a deal with the Astros, but then on June 15th, a deal gets done.
As we discussed in the Neil Allen episode, he was sent to the Mets in exchange for Neil Allen and Rick Owenby. And Mark, as a Neil Allen superfan, were you depressed by this, or were you excited to have the former MVP come to your beloved New York Mets?
So as I remember it, I was a sophisticated super fan even at age 8, and I'm pretty sure that I heard the announcement of this trade on the radio and that I reacted positively to it. And we should point out, too, that at the time, the trade really doesn't make sense because Neil Allen is pitching, like, bad, like really bad. And if you remember, I think I told the story in the Neil Allen episode that I met Neil Allen at a baseball card show and he promised to pitch better. And it doesn't make sense except that Whitey Herzog had this infatuation with him that seemed to really want him.
And he did end up pitching better, just in St. Louis. And Herzog said, "We needed pitching. Besides, Keith wasn't running out ground balls. I would have traded Babe Ruth if he wasn't running out ground balls. The funny thing is, Keith never loafed on defense." When the trade was announced on the Busch Stadium scoreboard, the fans booed. The Post-Dispatch said, "The Mets are getting a great hitter and a great first baseman, but they're also getting a good guy." So they apparently disagreed with Whitey Herzog, a man who has grown up a lot in the last 3 years.
If you read the Post-Dispatch coverage from the day after, the columnists are like perplexed by this deal. It doesn't make sense to them. I think the New York people probably similarly, except in a more positive way.
Meanwhile, Keith wasn't happy about it at all. The Mets were in last place, and he called his agent to ask if his deferred income was enough to retire on, because he thought maybe he would just quit baseball and retire rather than move to New York. But the agent gave him the tough news that no, it wasn't enough. And so Heath reluctantly went ahead. He was afraid of New York. When he was a young player, a teammate on a road trip took him out of the hotel and kind of pointed in the direction of Central Park and said, "Don't go there." Pointed over toward Hell's Kitchen and said, "Don't go there." And then pointed toward the Upper East Side and said, "If you want to go any place, you can go there." So he had, I would say, an unsophisticated view of life in New York City. When Keith arrived, Rusty Staub showed him around New York and helped him acclimate himself and grow to love the Big Apple.
And initially, Keith had a bad attitude. His brother Gary went to a Mets game in San Francisco and saw his brother take batting practice and wasn't showing much emotion, was just kind of flailing at the ball. And he confronted his brother afterward and said, "That man was out there throwing batting practice and you were wasting his time." And that man was Bobby Valentine. and he said, "Do you think you're better than the guys here? You're not. You've embarrassed yourself and you've embarrassed me." So Gary taking on Juan's mantle.
The other thing that happened was that Keith had a conversation with his dad. I don't know how his dad necessarily knew this, but his dad told him that the Mets had a lot of young, promising pitching coming. Maybe he read it in Baseball America. Maybe he read it in the Sporting News. He had to have seen it somewhere, because being in California, how would he have known? But that conversation also kind of turned his view more positively toward the Mets.
I read something similar that either his dad or his brother had a strong favorable opinion for Daryl Strawberry as well, having seen him on ESPN, I think during the time of the strike. So they had some inside information, but the Mets did lose 94 games that first season. But Keith hit 306 in the 95 games that he played in New York.
He also quit cocaine in 1983, which was an important move. He said, "You want to go to sleep and you can't. I don't like the high anymore." And he said that losing that taste made it easier for him to quit. Whether that's how it went down or not, we don't know for sure, but it was a big step and positive move for him. Also a positive time career-wise for him, he signed a 5-year contract with the Mets for $8.4 million. He was going to be a key player on the team that had a great farm system, as Dad was keen to point out. So there was hope for 1984. Keith was an all-star again. Gold Glover again in 1984, hitting .311 with 15 homers. The Mets went from 94 losses to 90 wins. This was Doc Gooden's rookie year. Daryl Strawberry in his second season. Ron Darling and Sid Fernandez in their first full season. This was a team that was really coming together.
And in 1985, they were even better, on the verge of greatness. In the offseason, they made the trade for Gary Carter, trading away the great Floyd Yeomans, and the Mets won 98 games, challenged the Cardinals for NL East supremacy down to the wire. Keith continued to be great, great defense, hitting .309, .129 OPS plus, and that was pretty much standard for his time in New York. He also had a record 24 game-winning RBIs. While Mark may disagree with me, this is a garbage stat on the back of these 1988 Topps cards, because it tells you that he may have driven in the first run of an 11-0 win, or he could have hit a game-winning home run. But 1988 was actually the last year that it was an official stat, because it was kind of meaningless. But Keith Hernandez holds the all-time record for game-winning RBIs with 129. I'm surprised that he's not in the Hall of Fame with stats like that.
I like game-winning RBIs, and I think the reason that I like them is because Keith Hernandez was good at them. I think if he hadn't been, I wouldn't have liked them. But I do want to counter what you said by pointing out that if you go to the splits page on baseballreference.com and you look at Keith Hernandez in high-leverage situations, 1982, 336, 943 OPS, 1984, 343, 946 OPS, 1985, the year that we're talking about, 422, 1,089 OPS, 1986, 350, 982 OPS. I think that there's a good argument for Keith Hernandez being pretty good in high leverage situations.
I agree. I think that those are better indications of Keith Hernandez as a great clutch player than the game-winning RBI stats. Mark, Keith wrote a book about this season. You would think he would have written a book about the 1986 season, but is there anything else to add about 1985 from Keith's book?
Oh boy, so this book is 480 pages as a paperback. I think he was basically trying to write Ball 4 for the 1980s. They did a 1985 version, and then after they won the World Series, they added 75 pages for it, and they got it to 480. And if you look at the book, he's very blunt, and I think this kind of foreshadows his broadcast style. If you open to page 175, he says, "We're losing the way we were winning a month ago. We're making bonehead plays." Page 257, the writers interrogate us about an alleged inconsistency. All those runs against the Braves, none against the Reds. Ridiculous. Winning 15 of 20, when is that inconsistent? So he was very outspoken in this book. It's a really good book. He became quite prolific in that regard a little later on.
Late in that season, Keith was called to testify at the Pittsburgh drug trials. In these trials, seven major league players testified against Curtis Strong, a former chef and caterer accused of drug trafficking and setting up drug deals for players. The players who testified against Curtis Strong were granted immunity from prosecution if they named names. So late in 1985, Hernandez is visited by Peter Uberoth, the commissioner of baseball, and he's told that he wouldn't be suspended for his participation in the trials. But then in early 1986, the commissioner announces that players who testified would be suspended for a year unless they agreed to, one, donate 10% of their salary to a drug abuse prevention program, two, perform 100 hours of drug-related community service, and three, participate in random drug testing for the rest of their career. And Hernandez felt like this was a total flip from the commissioner, and some players felt that the commissioner was more concerned about his own self-promotion and being the superhero fighting against drugs. Keith thought about appealing this decision, but instead accepted the penalty and was able to play in 1986. He would also say in April of that year that baseball was drug-free. I think some might agree to disagree on that.
Now we're at 1986, the culmination of the Mets' ascendancy. Keith had a great and typical year for him. 310 average, fifth in the National League, led the National League with 94 walks, drove in 83, and started in the All-Star game. Keith was the most valuable player by WAR on the Mets that year. Impressive for a team that had Doc Gooden, Daryl Strawberry, Gary Carter, and Lenny Dykstra. And the Mets won 108 games, winning the National League East by 21.5 games. In the playoffs, this is his second playoff appearance. Hernandez hit .269 with three RBIs and three runs scored in the six-game series against the Astros. In Game 6, the Mets were down 3-0 in the ninth inning. Bob Knepper had a shutout going and had given up only two hits and no runs to that point. Then Lenny Dykstra tripled and Mookie Wilson singled him home.
And I'll finish this out because I was at Hebrew school at the time listening to the game on the radio. Dykstra tripled, Wilson singled, as you said. Keith came to the plate. He was 0 for 3 at that point. He had called his brother Gary during the game from the clubhouse. Gary said, "Nipper's getting tired. You'll get a pitch to hit. Get on top of it. Drive it into the alley." And sure enough, he does. He doubled to score Wilson. He scored the tying run on a rain night sacrifice fly.
That was the only hit in Keith's seven at-bats in that 16-inning game, but the Mets would win it and make the World Series. In that World Series, Keith was relatively invisible for the first six games. He was 5 for 22, all singles, five walks. He had one run and one RBI, so he was getting on base, but didn't really show up. But then in Game 7, just like in 1982, he came through again.
So the Mets were down 3-0, one out, bottom of the sixth. Same kind of situation where Bruce Hurst was shutting the Mets down, similar to Bob Knepper. Lee Mazzilli, Mookie Wilson get hits. Tim Tuffle walks. They load the bases. Keith comes up to the plate. Sure enough, line drive, base hit, two runs score. It's 3-2. There's a weird play that happened next. Gary Carter comes up and hits a line drive to shallow right field. Dwight Evans dives for it, misses it, but he kind of traps it, and you can't tell whether or not he caught it. And Keith gets caught. He's like staying between first and second. He's not sure what to do. Finally, the umpire says, you know, the ball's in play. Keith gets there too late. Dwight Evans throws to second base. They force him out, but the run scores to tie the game 3-3. And on from there, Ray Knight hits a go-ahead home run in the seventh inning off Calvin Schiraldi, who was put into the game again after losing game six. Mets go on to score more. Jesse Orozco even gets a hit to keep the offense going for the Mets. They're up 8-5 in the ninth inning, and they wind up winning the game as they retire the side 1-2-3 in the ninth. Jesse Orozco throws his glove to the sky, and Keith and the Mets are world champions.
And Hernandez did drive in the sixth run of that game, so the decisive run, as Boston ended up scoring five, driven in by Keith Hernandez, played a big part after that relatively quiet first few games. A big moment, and probably made up for them trading away your best player, I'd say.
Sure, I think so.
Along with the World Series ring, the Mets earned the prestigious honor of inclusion in the Nintendo game RBI Baseball. And for that, we go to the RBI Corner with Brian. And we are back in the RBI Corner. Brian, back-to-back weeks, we're excited to have you back to talk about the Mets in RBI Baseball and Keith Hernandez.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here. I think we last talked about the Mets in the Danny Heap episode, so it's been some time since we've discussed the Mets. For me, they're squarely part of the middle class in RBI Baseball, along with teams like San Francisco and Minnesota. I think they're probably the bottom of that tier, which makes them the third worst team in the game. You want the Mets to be really good. You know, in RBI Baseball, the Mets are based off their 86 season, since that's when they made the playoffs. And these players were so great and famous, and saying their names brings back such fond memories of the 86 World Series. They do have a pretty good middle of the order. The 3-4-5 is all very good, each with some power, and Daryl Strawberry is a real superstar. But one of the problems is that while they have some speed, their fast players are poor hitters, and the bottom of the lineup is bad. They are very left-handed, which is good, but not necessarily for their fast players. So in RBI Baseball, a lot of times you pull the ball, and if you have a fast left-handed hitter, you might be pulling it to second base and not beating out those infield singles. So sometimes it's better to have your faster players be right-handed, and that's not the case with the Mets. In terms of their pitching, centers around Dwight Gooden, and he throws very hard, and he's pretty good. And they have a lefty sidearmer in Jesse Orozco, who's very fun to pitch with. All in all, I'd say the Mets are average to below average in the game, despite the fact that they won 108 games in 1986, just an absolutely amazing season. I'd still slot them behind teams like Minnesota that only won 85 games.
And how about Keith Hernandez? How is he?
Well, as we discussed in the Willie Hernandez episode, players don't have mustaches in RBI Baseball, and specifically we talked that through with Tom Brookins. And while Tom Brookins pulled a lot of power from his mustache and thus became one of the most powerful hitters in the game, Keith Hernandez merely has very good power. It's actually the third most power on the Mets, but it would be the eighth most on a team like the Red Sox. He's the number three hitter, so I talked about that middle of the lineup for the Mets, and he's part of that 3-4-5 triumvirate along with Gary Carter and Daryl Strawberry, but he might be the weakest of the three. He's left-handed, decent power, but he's also very slow, and you don't get any appearance from Keith Hernandez's cat. So for those who don't know, Keith Hernandez's cat is uncredited, but the undisputed star of the Once Upon a Time in Queens 30 for 30 documentary. Despite RBI Baseball's Japanese origins, there are no cats in the game.
It is a truly shocking omission. With or without the cat, do you keep Keith Hernandez in the lineup?
Absolutely, you have to. He's probably the third best hitter on the Mets, but it's a team where the other five hitters in the lineup probably don't crack the lineup of the better teams. So you keep Keith Hernandez in because he can help you win games, but with the Mets, you're hoping that he hits some home runs because they don't have a whole lot of power outside of the middle of their lineup.
Brian, perhaps he would have more mustache power if he had started those Just for Men commercials a few years earlier.
Unfortunately, all the players in IBA Baseball only have hats on, so you can't tell whether Just for Men is working out for Keith.
Well, hairless players, hairless cats, whatever the case, we really enjoy having you back. Thank you, Brian, very much.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
In 1987, Keith parlays the great success in the World Series to even higher heights, and that is appearing on Sesame Street.
He made two appearances. I'm not sure if it was the same episode, but he taught both the count how to play baseball, and I'll say that the count, I don't think he got the rules of the game. He just wanted to swing and continue counting strikes. I mean, that's kind of his shtick. And Keith and Mookie Wilson taught Mr. Snuffleupagus a little too well.
Okay, Snuff, you ready? I got a good feeling about this one. Come on.
All right.
Count of three. 1, 2, 3.
I did it. I hit the ball.
Snuffy, I think you're ready for the Little Leagues.
Little Leagues? He's ready for the Mets. Well, there's just one problem, guys.
What's that?
What's Mr. Steinbrenner gonna say when he finds out I broke his window?
I guess all six-year-olds maybe knew who George Steinbrenner was in 1987. Along with that prestigious film credit, Keith was named captain, explaining that little C on his shirt, the first team captain in Mets history. He had another good season in 87, playing 154 games. This would be the last time in his career that he would play more than 100. He hit 290 with a career-high 18 home runs, so the rabbit ball was working out for Keith. The Mets won 92 games, but fell just short of the Cardinals, finishing 3 games back. And in 1987, according to Seinfeld lore, on June 14th, Keith committed a terrible error against the Phillies, costing the Mets the game, earning the ire of Newman. In reality, on that day, the Mets defeated the Pirates, and Keith had a home run and two RBIs and scored 2 runs in a win.
So Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David often went with what was funny, and June 14th, 1987 sounds funnier than the actual real-life version of the game that they were referring to. April 12th, 1986, Mets lose to the Phillies in Philadelphia, so it doesn't sync up as well because you got the scene at Chase Stadium in Seinfeld. Mets lose in 14 innings. Mets were up 3 runs in the ninth. Ninth inning starts with a Keith Hernandez error. They blow the lead. They lose the game in 14. That's the game that the Seinfeld people were at that inspired Our Day Was Ruined, so to speak.
We'll dig into that episode in a bit. 1988, Keith was playing well into June, hitting 295 and on pace for over 100 RBIs. But he had injury problems. He missed a couple weeks with a hamstring injury in late June. He came back and 2 games later tore that hamstring, missing the next 37 games.
I saw it live. It was terrible. It was like a guy had been shot. He was writhing on the turf in Montreal in pain. To add insult to injury, the Mets were winning in the ninth inning. They blew the game, lost the game, and lost the next 5 in a row. So his impact was felt immediately.
He played only 95 games that year, hitting 276 with 11 home runs, OPS plus of 120. This was the final of his 11 straight gold gloves. Meanwhile, the Mets won 100 games, and Keith had another chance in the playoffs. The Mets and Dodgers went to 7 games in the series. Keith got hits in the first 4 games, hitting 429 with a homer in game 2. But then he went 1-for-12 in the last 3 games as the Dodgers won the series and ended up going to the World Series.
That would be the last playoff experience for Keith. 1989, he was again limited by injury, breaking a kneecap in a collision. He played only 75 games, hit just 233, and for the first time since 1975 had an OPS plus under 100. He was a free agent after that season and signed a 2-year deal with Cleveland worth $3.5 million. He didn't make it 2 seasons. In 1990, he played 43 games, ended up retiring after that season, and had back surgery in 1991.
So closing the book on Keith Hernandez, 17 seasons in the major leagues, a .296 batting average with 2,182 hits, 1,071 RBIs, 1,070 walks, which is 95th all-time. Defensively among first basemen, he was 21st in putouts, 5th in assists, 11th in double plays turned, a career fielding percentage of .994, which is 48th all-time, and first all-time in total zone runs, which is like defensive runs saved before there was defensive runs saved. 11 straight gold gloves, 5 all-star games, 1 MVP, and 2 World Series rings. And Mark, who did Keith love to face?
So this is my favorite part of the show when you guys bring this up. I nominate Steve Trout, who was a left-handed pitcher, would have been with the Cubs at the time that Hernandez was with the Mets and the Cardinals. 17 for 28, that's a .607 batting average. And then among the more prominent names, Oral Hershiser, 34 at-bats, .441 batting average, and no strikeouts.
And how about hated to face?
So, 3 Hall of Famers had ownage of him. Burt Blyleven, he hit .133. Don Sutton, .143. Lee Smith, .160. And those are all in decent amounts of at-bats. But a couple other guys, too. Joe Hesketh, who is a lefty, primarily for the Expos, 2 for 19 against Hesketh. And Vern Rule of the Astros, 2 for 20 against Vern Rule. Though he kept hitting the ball against him, he did not strike out against Vern Rule.
How about for the Hall of Fame?
Keith was on the ballot for 9 years. He topped out at 10.8%, and his percentage didn't go up after that. It actually then dropped off, and in his 9th year, he got under 5% and didn't have a final year on the ballot. It's a very strange trajectory, or more like a parabola.
He did have a 116 rating in the Hall of Stats, which meant that statistically, there's a strong case for him to be in the Hall of Fame. How about in retirement?
Early in Keith's retirement, he was in that Seinfeld episode that we mentioned earlier. This is the 2-part episode, The Boyfriend. Jerry and George bump into Keith Hernandez in the gym locker room after they were playing a spirited game of basketball. And then Jerry develops a bit of a man crush on Keith Hernandez. And it's kind of a good display of the difficulty of making friends as an adult. But then also, Keith wants to go on a date with Elaine. And then Kramer and Newman get involved. And they were at this game in 1987, where Keith Hernandez made this egregious error leading to 5 runs and a Mets loss, and they confronted Keith afterwards and said, "Nice game, pretty boy." And then there was spit.
Mm.
And was it Keith? Was it someone else? And this remains one of the most popular Seinfeld episodes, and Keith said he still gets approached about it, often by non-baseball people. They recognize him more for this. Even among some baseball people, they are more likely to ask him about Seinfeld than about his playing career.
That episode, because of the allusion to the movie JFK, is an iconic episode in American TV. It's well worth the attention it got, and he did a great job.
And compared to Danny Tartable's performance, and even the way that Danny Tartable was shoehorned in, and some of the Yankees stuff gets shoehorned into other episodes, this one, while it was outrageous and silly, it fit better, and it just made more sense, and also was very random that it's just, you know, it's Keith Hernandez.
It's a pretty iconic line. Who does he think he is? I'm Keith Hernandez.
Keith is also a prolific author.
Yeah, so he's written a bunch of books. He wrote If at First, which was the book about the 1985 season, 400 pages plus. Shea Bai is a book about the end of Shea Stadium. I'm Keith Hernandez is a more recent work that is about the beginning, mostly, of his baseball career. It's a memoir. It's mostly about his time with the Cardinals. And then Pure Baseball, which is really interesting, although I will confess that I say that not having fully read it. He basically watches 2 baseball games and writes about everything that happens in them, with a co-author, like explaining every single play. It's like watching him on TV now, except that it's in written form.
Keith was also in Just for Men ads with Walt Frazier, talking about his hair color, talking about his mustache color, talking about Emmett Smith's weird beard. And he's also been an announcer with the Mets. He started in 2006 with SNY, and he's been in the booth ever since. As some players tend to do as announcers, he has some tropes. He has a lot of stories about Lou Brock. He said some dumb stuff on Twitter and in the booth, including in 2006 when he pointed out a female member of the Padres training staff and said that women don't belong in the dugout. And he later apologized for that remark, as this was a member of the Padres training staff who had every right to be in the dugout. Mark, as a Mets fan, How do you feel about Keith, the announcer?
I think when you look at Keith, you look at them as a group, and that's Gary, Keith, and Ron, which are Gary Cohen, Keith Hernandez, and Ron Darling. And together, they are, I think for someone of my age or someone of my dad's age, they are basically perfection, particularly when they're together. Keith is very sharp. As they said before they started in 2006, right before the first spring training game, Keith goes to Ron, "I'll take the hitting, you take the pitching, and we'll just go from there." They've followed that formula for the most part. It's a smart broadcast. It gets a little goofy at times. Keith has done a better job in recent years of restraining himself when he's about to say something that could get a little weird. They're older, admittedly, and they appeal to an older demographic, including myself. I think they're very good. And Keith and Ron are like, I would say they're hot and cold with some stats, some of the statistical things. I was pleased. Keith Hernandez once shouted out the company that I work for, Sports Info Solutions, for our notes on the home plate umpires for the games that we were providing SNY for a few days, which was really cool. There are certain things he can't wrap his head around, but there are a lot of things on which I think that he and the nerd baseball types, if you want to use that phrase, would agree. You guys do the loves to face, hates to face. I had the idea that we should do loves to watch, hates to watch for Keith, because one thing that comes up frequently in the Met game broadcast is Keith's love for Robert Mitchum movies. I know none of them. I know nothing about any of them, but every so often he brings them up, and he always seems to know, in, like, right off the top of his head, whatever the anecdote is. When it comes to movies, he's very much a man's man kind of movie fan. And then hates to watch. He's coined a few terms as a broadcaster. Bad fundies is one of them. He gets very frustrated when players exhibit bad fundamentals. You can detect it immediately in the booth, and it's usually quite amusing.
We appreciate Robert Mitchum's music career for his Calypso record, as referenced in some episode.
I don't remember.
Why were
which
we talking
one,
about but... Robert Mitchum? I don't remember.
Isn't Robert Mitchum an old Westerns actor?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Did he have a Calypso record? Yes, he did. Why? I do not know.
And why did we reference it? I haven't the slightest idea. We'll find out. But we love good fundamentals, though, and are on board with good fundies, not bad fundies.
We also love cats. And one thing I do know about Keith Hernandez is that he has a very old cat named Haji, a Bengal cat who I think is still alive and might be 21 years old. Haji has become a social media sensation and sometimes shows up on broadcasts, at least when Keith was recording from home. Keith also posts pictures of them on his social media. It's a very cute cat. Keith really does love his cat a lot, it appears. There's, I think, a GQ article about him and his cat. It's very endearing.
We started this episode knowing that Keith Hernandez was Dad's favorite Met. He's had an iconic career, great mustache, on one of the most famous episodes in Seinfeld history, and loves cats, and that's very important. But now that we've looked at his career a little bit more, what do we think?
Keith was inducted into the Cardinals Hall of Fame in 2021. He's been a member of the Mets Hall of Fame since 1997, and rightfully so. From 1984 to 88, the Mets averaged 97 wins a year, and Keith was at the center of that team, eventually becoming the co-captain with Gary Carter, winning a World Series in that stretch. And in 2022, the Mets retired his number. He threw out the first pitch, and his brother Gary caught the first pitch. Gary said that he considered himself Keith's reality check. He said, "To me, he's still my younger brother. He's not Keith Hernandez, the superstar." Gary said he wouldn't go back and trade spots with Keith. He said he was perfectly happy to watch his brother play and let Keith handle the pressure. So where their dad may have tried to insert himself into the relationship, Gary was perfectly happy to sell insurance in California and let Keith be the big-time superstar. These other two Hall of Fames do lead to the question, should Keith be in the Baseball Hall of Fame? And so I was looking at how he stacks up against other historically great players as well as other first basemen. In terms of wins above replacement, he is the 124th position player all time in WAR. On Baseball Reference, he is the 21st ranked first baseman in JAWS, right around Mark McGwire, Hank Greenberg, Bill Terry, Harmon Killebrew. And his peak 7 years of WAR were 41.2, right around the average of all 24 Hall of Fame first basemen. He had a better peak than Hall of Famers like Fred McGriff, Eddie Murray, Gil Hodges, Orlando Cepeda, David Ortiz. And he was just really consistent for a decade. From 1977 to 1987, he played 149 or more games every season, except for the strike season. But in that strike season, he played every game that the Cardinals played. So just very durable, very consistent. And over a different stretch from 1976 to 1988, he was the best first baseman by wins above replacement in hits, doubles, and runs. And in that time, he was second in offensive WAR, second in OPS plus, RBIs, and batting average. He was one of the best first basemen of his era in either league, and probably the best National League first baseman of that era. On defense, 11 straight Gold Gloves is the most ever for a first baseman. Mark, what did your dad say about Keith?
My dad told Keith Hernandez on a New York City subway that you are the best first baseman that I have ever seen. My dad has watched baseball for 70 years, so I will take his word for it.
And Mark, in your opinion, do the numbers and the eye test agree?
So this is funny because I was basically asked that same question on my ESPN job interview, and I leaned strongly towards saying yes for him. When you look at what you just pointed out, that 13-year chunk where he's this terrific player. Sporting News took a poll in the mid-80s of the most feared hitters in baseball, most feared hitters in the National League. It was Dale Murphy and Keith Hernandez. I'm a Dale Murphy for the whole guy, too, generally. You guys talked about that pretty recently. The other thing is the defense. He eliminated the bunt, like literally eliminated the bunt, because he would come in so hard, he would play so close to the batter. There are numerous examples of him throwing guys out on bunts where they were trying to sacrifice a guy over, and he was throwing and getting the lead runner. And how many players in baseball can you identify who had one of the most important hits in Game 7, which is like the ultimate game, Game 7, of two different World Series, 1982 and 1986. So I think you take those three things combined with what you said, and that edges him over the top, and I think he should be in the Hall of Fame.
You mentioned the bunting. We didn't even discuss that. But in any highlight reel of Keith Hernandez, it is cat-like, it is Haji-like in his ability to get to the ball. Before you have even seen the ball hit the ground, Keith Hernandez is in the screen. And that ability to take away the bunt is just amazing and changes the game, and also made it difficult for National League managers to know what to do with their pitchers. Because if your pitcher is going to bunt and Keith Hernandez is going to somehow turn that into a double play, or you're going to have your pitcher on base running, it totally messes up your game plan. The case against him for the Hall of Fame, I guess, is that he was a different kind of first baseman at a time when power was necessary. He only had less than 150 home runs in his career, 2,100 hits. So for an average guy, didn't have close to 3,000 hits. Not a lot of black ink on that card. There were also comparisons to Don Mattingly, also playing in New York at the time. Don Mattingly was this power hitter, MVP in the other league, playing for the Yankees. So the comparison, I think, with numbers sometimes would favor Mattingly, but in terms of wins above replacement, definitely favors Hernandez. Also, playing in St. Louis didn't help that first part of his career, limiting the number of home runs and power numbers that he would have had. And his drug use, that served as a black mark on his resume, and isn't really fair considering that he quit and recovered. And that, I think, should be something that's celebrated rather than punished. But because he was on the ballot at a slightly different time when writers may have taken that into consideration, it hurt his case. I think also when we talk about the Hall of Fame and talking about fame generally, if Keith Hernandez had been on a show like Seinfeld during his career, his stature would have been so much higher. The fact that people now, the number one thing they want to talk to him about is these two episodes of Seinfeld that came 2 years after he retired, where he was more just Keith Hernandez, known for baseball, now is Keith Hernandez known for Seinfeld. Mark, do you have any final thoughts on Keith Hernandez, a guy who went from traded for your favorite Met and then to deliver some of those iconic moments?
He's from New York now. This is a guy that grew up in San Francisco and started his Major League Baseball career in the Midwest, and he winds up coming all the way across the country, and no matter what happens, he's identified with the 86 Mets, which are an iconic team for people in New York City. He's regarded as one of the most integral people for that team. The Seinfeld episode just kind of adds to that. The thing that I hope as Gary, Keith, and Ron move into their, I guess, their older years, is that they go out, much like Jerry Seinfeld did, they go out on top, and that you get the best of Keith Hernandez for these next few years before he retires to Sag Harbor and in Florida. They want to go out on top. So that's, I think that's something that will be cool for Met fans to see in the next few years.
Definitely something for us to look forward to and enjoy their next few years on the air together. Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming on the show and giving your insight about this player who has been such a favorite of yours. Where can listeners find you?
Listeners can find me on Twitter, although I'm there less now than I used to be, at Mark A. Simon Says. And I'm also at Sports Info Solutions. You should check out our Twitter at SIS_baseball.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, David, for the story today. And thank you to you at home. If you've ever poured a beer on Roger McDowell's head, we'd love to see the proof. You can send it to us at 1988 Tops Podcast. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.